It's now time for your favorite guilty pleasure.
The E2 Books Show.
Check your innocence at the door and welcome two of the men your mama warned you about.
Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
Welcome back to the E2 Books Show. Scott, this is episode 2, and I can't believe we've made it this far, to be honest with you.
This is like nearly twice as many shows as we used to have. I'm not good with math. Maybe it's even fully twice as many.
There's got to be some sort of law against it, but it doesn't really matter because this is going to be the last show because 2 is as high as I can count. So it's been nice knowing you folks.
It's been a good run.
But today, somehow, we have bagged the author with the number one book on Kindle.
Number one.
Not number two, number one. Or number, what's the number after 2, 4, 5?
I don't know. Whatever.
Doesn't matter because she's number one. Moonlight Child, fantastic book. Author's name is Karen McQuestion. And we were so lucky to have her come on the show. I'm a bit surprised she accepted, but I'm glad she did.
I just hope she doesn't regret her choices afterwards, but
I'm sure she does. But
I know I do every time.
Coming on the show with me or just regret in general?
Generally, yeah.
No, but she was fantastic. She was fantastic.
Grade,
and what are you talking about?
My regrets from the past. I'm just
he's all caught up in his regrets. Oh God. I shouldn't have brought it up. But she was fantastic in all seriousness. Let's talk about somebody with a solid grasp on the market and just the craft of writing.
Yeah, her craft as well. I agree.
Absolutely. I've written like about 20-ish books now. Is that right?
I believe. Right in and, that neighborhood.
Highly rated, highly reviewed. And again, Moonlight Child, number one book on Kindle. It doesn't get much better than that, does it? It doesn't get any better than that.
I don't think it does. There's no number zero, so.
Yeah, unless you went to number zero, and I think that would be way worse.
Yeah, I think so. I think that actually falls at the opposite end of the scale. This one goes to zero.
Yes. Anyway, it was great having Karen on, and I'm not going to say any more because I'll just continue to ruin it.
Yeah, I think we've screwed it up enough already, so.
Enjoy Karen's interview. Karen McQuestion is a best-selling author who writes for adults, teens, and kids. Some of her titles include Hello, Love, The Moonlight Child, The Long Way Home, and the Edgewood series. Her books have been translated into German, Spanish, Polish, Korean, Turkish, Russian, and Czech, and are available internationally in English. All told, her books have sold over 2 million copies. Her publishing story has been covered by The Wall Street Journal, Entertainment Weekly, and NPR. She's also appeared on ABC's World News Now and America This Morning. Karen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, I know it can be nerve-wracking coming on somebody else's program, so I wanted to start out with a simple question. There's something to put you at ease. Okay. And that is, what is the secret to life?
How much time do you have?
30 seconds, go.
No pressure.
No, not at all. No, but in all seriousness, your book, Moonlight Child, hit number one on Amazon Kindle in, I think it was July. Is that right?
Yeah, and actually it went down and it popped back up. So right now, as we're speaking, it's number one.
Just checked it today and it's still up there.
Yeah.
I guess my question for that, would you like us to begin worshiping you now or wait until after the show?
No, your call. Yes. Whatever you're more comfortable with.
He's like, both?
I don't know.
You got to settle a long-standing question that Craig and I have had. We heard that when your book goes to number one, not only do you get the little bestseller banner on your listing, but Jeff Bezos actually flies his rocket ship to your house and puts one on your forehead as well. Is that true?
I've heard that too, actually, but it hasn't happened yet. I'm just looking out my window like any minute now.
I think, yeah, he's too busy. He's flying that rocket ship to other places, man. I think.
He's got a few things going on.
I know. He needs to get his priorities straight, in my opinion. No, but Moonlight Child is definitely striking a chord with people. And it, why do you think that is?
You know, I've actually analyzed this because I've written more than 20 books and, you know, I've done well. I'm really pleased, but nothing like this. I just could not have anticipated it. I have a good friend, Pamela Kelly, who also is just so smart about the business end of things. And she told me she bought it and read it to analyze it. I mean, partially because she wanted to read it, but it's like she loves to kind of like crack the code and see why things resonate with readers, which I do too. Mm-hmm. And her theory was that it has the hallmarks of a thriller or a domestic suspense, but it's a kinder, gentler domestic suspense. So there's nothing, you know, it's really not edge of your seat reading, but you want to know what happens next, or most readers want to know what happens next. So that's her thought on it, is it's, you know, it's kind of appeals to people who like to read, you know, a little more plot driven twists and turns, but then also don't want to walk away with that kind of feeling you get sometimes when you're reading something really disturbing. Mm-hmm. So that's her thought. And my thought is it's a child in peril and in a regular neighborhood, and somebody who's very observant notices things that kind of alerts them to this. And even though the authorities check it out and say, no, you're wrong, she kind of goes with her instinct to kind of persevere. And that I think on some level, all of us think that we would be the hero of a situation like that, whether it's the bank is getting held up when you're inside, you think, well, I would have, you know, which I probably wouldn't have, but you know, you like to think that under different circumstances, that would be you. And so I think that part of it appeals as well. Just my theory. I don't honestly know.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because we can do all of the market research and we can turn all this up, but at some point it's, or some level, it's just the stars align.
Absolutely. And the timing. So would this book have done well a couple of years ago or going forward a few years? Maybe not, probably not. It's the right book at the right time and the right circumstances. So a lot of it's luck.
Yeah.
Every author either consciously or subconsciously draws from their own lives in their books. And, you know, some take it even further, hiding Easter eggs for friends and stuff like that. Is that something you've ever done?
I've used people's last names because that's difficult for me. I like suddenly I'll freeze up when I'm like, okay, I've got the first name. And so, and then I'll oftentimes forget. And then a friend will be like, oh, I saw what you did there. You worked me in there. So I'll be like, what? So then I look like an idiot who doesn't know what she wrote. And so I've done that kind of thing. And I wrote a young adult paranormal series that was really fun. It was the only series I wrote. So sometimes in chapter three, you know, it's you flip back to something that happened chapter or the book three.
Right.
You go back to something previous and you build on it. So I've done that, but not specifically like what you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
We have a mutual friend, Scott and I do, Eric Thurm. I don't think he makes no secret of this. So I don't think it's a big deal. He does Easter egging like crazy, and he'll use people's names, acquaintances for street names and
oh, fun
town name. And then he uses this to sell books.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, your name is,
he'll do a live event and say, so-and-so you're on page 23. And the next thing you know, he's got another sale. The guy's a genius.
and then they go tell people about it because they're in a book. Is like,
oh, clever. Yeah. That's a good idea.
I think I ended up as a street name in one, but the joke was on him because it's one we produced the audio book. So I got to hear it for free. So. That was a wasted Easter egg.
He didn't get a sale out of that one.
Well, I mean, you're clearly doing very well in your author career, and congratulations on the number one. That's amazing. What does success as a writer look like to you besides the number one? Is there something else that you strive for?
I think like all of us and all authors, having readers that actually read your books and enjoy them and recommend them to others, that's always number one. Yeah. And when I think about success, I think that it's changed over the years. I remember when I first uploaded my books to Kindle in 2009, we did it like on a weekend, and by Monday, four people had downloaded it. And I mean, I didn't know four people that owned a Kindle. So yeah. I was like, well, somebody who didn't know me downloaded my books, and yeah. I'm getting actual money for this. I mean, it was just astounded. And I remember my husband saying when I got up to like 100, can you imagine if it gets to like four figures? And then, you know, I would imagine like an auditorium filled with like 186 people, you know? And so it's, you know, it does, you do ratchet it up with, you know, with each book, as far as you hope to carry over your previous readers, and you hope that you find new readers. One thing I always think of as an author is when you look on Amazon at the book page and you look at that chart that shows the star ratings, mm-hmm. I always say it should be like a tornado. You know, you want the top to be larger than the bottom, because right. not everyone's going to love your book, but you are hoping that more people do. So if your chart makes a boot, you're in trouble. You know, you should probably pull that book. But if it's a tornado, you can be happy.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think all of it's great. It's great to hear from readers. It's great to be able to say I can do this for a living. I never, never thought I'd be able to do that. And so, you know, the success is, and I keep kind of having little secret things that I'd like to have happen. Like at one point it was like, wouldn't it be great if it was translated into another language? And so I don't take any of it for granted. Now it's like, wouldn't it be great if one of my books made it into a movie or a series? So that's kind of been in the back of my mind. If it never happens, I still have gotten more than my share, but I would love it if that would happen. So if Netflix is watching this, right?
Oh yeah,
definitely, yeah.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, I'm just Scott, putting it out there.
Scott and I own Netflix.
Little no, fact.
Probably I should by this point. I spent enough money on it.
Seriously, yeah. You know? No, I would put money on one of your books making it to the.
Oh, I would have no problem believing that either.
Yeah. I like how you think.
Do you read your reviews besides paying attention to the geometric shapes of?
You know, I used to read every single review, and now with 20 some books, I scan them. I don't read them in detail. Initially, when I first started writing and publishing, the reviews, even the negative ones, if they were helpful, I would take note. I remember with the first couple books, or one in particular, they said several readers like had good things to say about the book, but thought it wrapped up too quickly at the end. Mm-hmm. And I had been actually following, I don't know if you know that, and I'm not sure where I got this information. It was sort of like the climax of your story should be at 92% in the book in total. I'd read that in some writing book, which I took everything as, you know, gospel back in the day when I knew nothing. Right. So I was like, okay, it's going to be 92%. I've got to shorten up the end because otherwise it's going to drag on too long and readers are going to, you know, that's going to be off-putting to them. And I want to do this right. And then readers were saying, no, it seemed like it wrapped up too quickly. So now I'm a more instinctual writer. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, 92% or it's 84%, if whatever feels right to me, that's generally what I go by. So right. Reviews have been really helpful to me that way.
Yeah. You mentioned instinct, and especially if, you know, if somebody's been writing for a while, you can feel the pace of the book.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it's time for something to happen. It's time to wrap it up. It's time for whatever. you get a sense of that pacing. But Scott and I were talking about reviews the other day, and I've gotten to the point where I don't really read them except when I first launch a book,
mm-hmm.
because it's like half the book was missing. Now, that's something you want to know, you know, right
away.
That
would be good to know. Yeah.
Something going terribly awry, but, and I look at the average rating or whatnot, because I'm telling you, you can have 2000 reviews on a book and you get one really bad one and 2000 good ones, for example. And I would remember the bad one.
Yeah. I can take that a step further. I only seem to like read them when the newest one is a bad one.
Oh.
Every single time. So that's why I read reviews now if I'm feeling a little too good about myself.
This will bring me down.
I know there'll be a stink all waiting for me in here. Yep.
Yeah, I'm getting kind of full of myself.
Oh, Dryden, let's see.
What is, now we're all of the three of us are writers, and we've all been writing for a long time. What is one thing that you love most about the writing community, and what is one thing that perhaps you would change about it?
You know, I was thinking about this the other day because all the information is online. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people that will help you if you're starting out, or even if you've been doing it a long time, like all of us have. If you have a question, my friend Pamela Kelly, who I mentioned before, is on a Facebook group called 20 Books to 50K. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
And she's on there quite a bit helping people ask questions. And so that it's been invaluable to me. Even now, I'll, you know, message a friend, I'm doing such and such. I'm getting stuck. And so the information is there. And I love that the writer community is there to lift each other up. I mean, somebody could love my books and read them within a short period of time. And that doesn't mean they're not going to read all of your books. I mean, it's not an either or proposition.
Right.
So nobody is taking your spot. I'm number one today. Next year, it'll be someone else, or, you know, tomorrow could be someone else. It's just you do it because you love it. And then you find your people. For me, it's been online. I have been in writers groups in person, but the writers group I was in, there weren't a lot of novelists, which is a kind of a different thing, is creating a book length fiction piece of work. And so to me, I think it's wonderful. When I first started out, I was on, do you remember CompuServe by any chance?
Yeah.
Yes. My husband had a computer, and this is how long ago it was. People called it a home computer. They'd go, "You have a home computer?" Like we had a centrifuge machine or something, right. You know? It was so bizarre. So after we put the kids to bed, I would go down in our unfinished basement where his computer was, and he had introduced me to the CompuServe message forms, which was like the precursor of everything that is now.
Right.
And I wasn't writing. I was thinking about writing. I had been thinking about writing, and I felt sort of like a wannabe person who was never going to get around to it. But in my heart, I thought at some point I would have the emotional space and time to do it. So I would go down in the basement and turn on CompuServe. And Diana Gabaldon, who wrote the Outlander series, was a regular at night.
Wow.
And so I never contributed. I don't think I posted even once. I was like, felt too intimidated. Mm-hmm. And I remember she would talk about her books, and she would ask something like, "I need a character in such and such location to accidentally ingest some poison. And I want them to get like deathly ill, but not die." And so, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, of course, it was a long time ago, but she had a question. And then somebody on the message forum would say, "My uncle is the foremost expert on poisonous plants. He teaches at some, you know, fancy university. I'll connect you." And I thought, well, isn't this phenomenal? I mean, what do people
Crazy.
Used to do?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, back then I was, you know, of course, now I, every time someone talks about Outlander, I feel like, oh, she's a friend of mine. I know her so well. But so I think that we're in an era that's ideal for authors and writers. You can write what you want or what you think is marketable. You can find out how to get the word out. You can find out about craft from other authors. People are really generous. They've been really generous to me. So did I answer that question?
That question and a couple we didn't even ask yet.
So. Yeah, that were better than the one we asked.
I'm kind of an overachiever that way. Yeah.
Well, so you have books that are successful in your own right. Is there one book out there that you wish that you had written?
I always have writer's envy, almost, I mean, a lot.
Right.
I do, but not about one particular book, because I feel like I would have written that book, but I would have done it different.
Mm-hmm.
But I do find myself, even books that I don't absolutely love, I'll be like, "Ooh, nice transition." Or that was clever how they worked that in.
Right, so, right.
And I feel like my shortcoming, in my opinion, is the language. I don't have a great literary styling. So when I see someone that pulls it off without it being too heavy-handed, I try to take note of it. I think that's really cool. Right. So I don't have one book I wish I wrote, but definitely I've suffered from writer's envy, but I try to channel it in a positive way.
See, I find your prose very accessible. Like, I don't know.
Oh, thank you.
Slipping on a nice warm sweater on a cool autumn evening or something. But the thing I liked about it is even when the subject matter isn't warm and comfy, your prose still is. And I think you kind of alluded to that early on, a thriller that's not going to leave you with nightmares kind of feel.
Thank you.
How long into your catalog did you have to write before you really felt as though you'd found your voice?
Well, I've never been a writer or an author who found my lane as far as, you know, I'm a romance author, I'm a thriller writer, I kind of follow the idea, which is something they tell you never, ever, ever do. Never. I mean, and so I don't know if I've gotten lucky that readers have been on board for the most part, or if it is a matter of my voice being consistent, mm-hmm. which is what you just asked about. I think my voice was consistent in that there's a couple things that are always the same. I don't use profanity. I don't use graphic violence, although people get shot or attacked or whatever. And there's no steamy sex scenes. Mm-hmm. So I remember pretty early on getting an email from a reader saying she really liked my books because she could recommend them to her 12-year-old daughter and to her older mom, right. And the three of them could read them. And so I do try to keep that in mind when I write, that's something people look for. But otherwise, I just follow the idea. And right. Part of the thing of having a voice is you can't help but have the voice you have. Mm-hmm. I mean... Right. There are times I've tried to be a little more literary, and my sister Kay, who's one of my first readers, is like, she just like crosses it out. Like, this just jumped out of nowhere. What the hell is this? So, you know, you can try to be who you are, but it just doesn't work. I want to paint like Michelangelo, but I'm more like, you know, Grandma Moses. So, but people like
I'm
that.
I'm more like Craig's twins, so you're ahead of me. like most of us, I'm sure there's days when the words just can't wait to jump out of your fingers onto the page, mm-hmm. and then there's days when it's more like pulling teeth. What do you find your balances? Are you more good flowing days or more days where it really feels like work?
Lately, it's more good flowing days. Once I realized people wanted to read what I wrote, and I was like, oh, it's you don't feel like you're writing into a void.
Right.
It's somebody who is looking forward to reading it, even if it's not, you know, the masses. It's not, I'm not Stephen King. But if you get that occasional email or Facebook message, if I mention I'm working on something and someone just jumps in and says, oh, I can't wait to read it, that helps a lot. It also helps that I don't have small children in the house anymore. Mm-hmm. My kids are all grown up. That's huge, huge, huge. So I always say if you have... you're a caregiver for anyone, an older person or a spouse maybe who's not doing well, or you have children. It takes a lot of emotional space to do that kind of thing. You don't just need the time. You need a physical place. You need right. the distractions to be gone. And so lately, I've been doing pretty well with keeping to a consistent schedule.
You are so right about that with the kids run, because I have small children at home, and you're right. It isn't about, this is like an epiphany for me, because I haven't really thought about it this way, but it's not just about having the time. It's like you have writing, even a page is such a huge effort when you're mm-hmm. surrounded by the chaos, mm-hmm. which 6-year-old boys always introduce into any situation. So that actually explains a lot to me, because there have been plenty of times when I've looked back at my output or productivity for the day or week for writing wise. And I'm like, wow, I did next to nothing. I mean, there's a level of guilt that comes along with that, because, you know, Scott and I have a lot of things planned, a lot of things we're working on, but it actually makes a lot of sense. I'm glad you said that.
Well, and two, as a parent, even if the kids aren't there, if one of my kids was having a problem and they were just heartbroken or stressed or, you know, I mean, I won't give specifics, but I could, all parents can. And even though they're at school, mentally, maybe that's, you know, still kind of, it's on my mind. And it kind of intrudes where when you're writing the book, you're trying to get into the character, immerse yourself in another world. And if mentally you're, you know, in seventh grade where the other kids are making fun of your kid, you know, you just want to go over there and clock someone. I mean, that's that you can channel that somewhat, but sometimes you can't, you know? Yeah.
Yes. Your adult female character probably shouldn't go into an elementary school and just
probably
start
not
smashing kids, but yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, in all seriousness, I think it's just a reminder to all of us and people who are watching me just to be gentle with yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
Cut yourself some slack. Cause it doesn't mean you're lazy. It doesn't mean you're not a good writer. It just means you've got stuff going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What is a common myth about writing or writers even that people hold, do you think?
You know what? This I'm glad to be able to say, because it's, people should know, it really is a job. It's the best job in the world. I love it. I'm very privileged. I've had lots of other jobs. This is the best one I've ever had. I can't imagine doing anything else. But books do not write themselves. I mean, and I had a friend who said, but you can write anytime you want, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I was like, yeah, but if it's like, you have to have a certain degree of discipline.
Yeah.
And also there's the business half of it too, which I would say the marketing business half used to be 20% of my time. And now it's maybe 50% of my time. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind doing it. I actually feel like I have a knack for some of it, but it really takes away from the writing. So you have to balance it. So that would be my biggest thing, is it's a job and it's a business. I remember talking to someone and we were talking about business, claiming business expenses. And she said, well, what kind of expenses would you have? You know, like, yeah, like you just have your notebook and your pen. Right? And I was like, oh are you kidding me? I have advertising. I have software I purchase. I have computer things. If I, you know, if I mail out giveaways, the cost of the books, the postage. I think I talked way beyond what she wanted to hear. I think she was like, her eyes glazed over. But I was like, oh, there, you wouldn't believe, if you saw my spreadsheet, you'd be like, man, she spends a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why, you know, one reason why maybe some people who jump into the indie writing world don't get, you know, end up getting out of it, because they cannot grasp that there is a business side to it. There's like, I just want to write.
Well, right. No.
Well, you know, I think all of us just want to write. That's the fun part. Yeah.
But while we're at it, we might as well sell a few. So.
Right, exactly.
Yep.
Well, it's like Kieran has said, I've heard you say more than once, people ask you if you would write books for free. And you're like, well, I did. And, you know, but we're past that now.
Yeah, I did for 10 years, but I was always hoping to make some money.
Exactly. Well, you're on this show, and thank you for being a guest on this show, but you're also the co-host of your own podcast. Why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. I have a podcast called Behind the Book. I think the official name is Behind the Book with Tess and Karen. So my friend, USA Today bestselling author Tess Thompson, I'm required to say that. I'm not. But she was the brainchild behind this, and she asked if I'd be her co-host. And we have really different personality types. I wasn't sure how I'd do, but we seem to complement each other's strengths and weaknesses, and it's been a lot of fun. So the premise is that we're interviewing people who are behind the book. So primarily authors, but also we had an audiobook narrator. We have upcoming a librarian, cover designer, just everybody that has to do with the making of a book or working in publishing. So it's been really fun. We just started, we have 11 episodes out, and we've taped a couple more, and I've learned so much. And I've actually found that this is sort of kickstarting my creativity in a way. It's really helped me to hear other people's perspectives on how they do it. And you kind of walk away, even though you just talk to the person for an hour, feeling like you have a good sense of who they are. Like you, if you would run into them again, you'd know them.
Right.
So I'm really glad to do it. I'm glad Tess asked me. I joke with her that she's going to like kick me out, but then she's going to have to find another woman named Karen because it's on the logo.
And, that was clever. That was clever of you to work yourself into the logo.
Good? That was good. So, and you know, not all Karens are nice. I've heard that a lot of them are just heinous. So she better hang on to me.
Yeah, really.
She Scott and I are offended on your behalf whenever that name is used. So.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
No, but yeah, definitely check it out. I've listened to all of the episodes of Behind the Book, so everybody check that out. We're right on the end of the time, but I want to make sure that people know where they can find you online.
I've got a website, KarenMcQuestion.com, and it's got all my social media links on there. And I'm also on Facebook. Just you can't not find me, it seems.
You cannot hide.
That's right.
All right. Karen McQuestion, author of the number one book on Amazon Kindle, Moonlight mm-hmm. Child. Go get it today. Thank you so much, Karen. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
The E2 Books Show.
E2 Books Show
by Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.